The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Join the Save Our Shirt movement today. More at saveourshirt.co.uk.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to make my country again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Welcome along, busy football show for you this evening. Later on this hour, we're going to hear from Uli Hesse, German football writer. He will talk to us about how the Bundesliga season is shaping up, including what's going to happen at Bayern now that Uli Hoeneß has stepped aside. There is something of a power vacuum there in the Bayern hierarchy. So that is on the way. Very shortly, we're going to be joined by Pat Nevin. We will, as you might imagine, be talking to him about events at Molineux last night. If you didn't see it for whatever reason, I'm sure you've heard what's happened at this stage. Paul Pogba wins a penalty in the 67th minute. He was tripped by Connor Cody, and then him and Marcus Rashford came together for a little bit of a chat. And very quickly it became apparent that Marcus Rashford was not going to take the penalty as he had against Chelsea. Pogba stepped up, missed the penalty, save, courtesy of Rui Patricio. They went back to the Sky studio. At that stage, we hadn't heard from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. It looked maybe like Pogba had pulled rank on Rashford and just taken the penalty off him. Gary Neville not best pleased in the Sky studio.
When, before he actually even took the penalty, I was fuming.
He knows, though. Look, I mean...
Look,
see his
the only reason I'm holding back 4 years ago when Morales took one off Baines, I called it a despicable act. It's treachery in football terms, taking a penalty off your teammate. However, we've looked back at the penalty from last week that Marcus Rashford took against Chelsea. And Paul Pogba walked up to Rashford and they have a long chat. I'm not sure whether Rashford took the one off Pogba last week and Pogba should have been taking the one last week, looking at what we've seen from the Chelsea game. We'll show it you after the break. But they have a long chat again. I don't like it. Why is there a debate on who takes a penalty? There should never be a debate. There's a penalty taker. Pogba's missed four at the club in the last 12 months. So you think that he's had his chance now. Rashford scored last week. Take the penalty. But there wasn't a leader out on the pitch. That's why you saw the clips in the footage there about basically there was James, there was Martial. They couldn't make a decision between them, but something wasn't right, Dave. I mean, we were watching, something's not right there. All I'm holding back off on is that initially I was fuming with Pogba. I thought, it's typical you, you're selfish. Why are you even thinking of taking a penalty off a player? But actually, last week's one, when I'm looking at it against Chelsea, we've got it down here now, it's weird. Something's not right, and only Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to be able to shed light on it.
So Neville was onto something there. He did very well to remember the Pogba chat with Rashford against Chelsea, and then eventually Ole Gunnar Solskjaer came out and spoke to Sky.
Paul Pogba did very well to win the penalty. Why then did he take it when because Marcus took it the week before?
Yeah, because the two of them are designated the penalty shooters, and it's up to them there and then who feels that this is mine.
Why that system? Why not just have one guy?
Because sometimes, you know, players just feel that they're confident enough to score. Paul scored so many penalties for us, and today Patricio made a good save.
So it's not a case of one guy taking it off another guy. It's whoever feels best on the day. There's a system in place. They're the two takers.
Yeah, you can see the slides before on the PowerPoint.
And that doesn't change after tonight, or do you look at
no.
it?
Not at all. If the two of them have been very confident before, and of course last week Marcus scored a goal. I'm sure he would have loved to, but Paul also was confident. So that's I like players with confidence and you know the feeling of I can do this.
And with that ridicule from every non-Man United supporting fan on social media and a few raised eyebrows to say the least amongst Manchester United fans, only one man can make sense of this. You're our designated. That's designated man to make sense of this, Pat Nevin. No two ways about it. I don't care what the PowerPoint slides say. You're our only man for it.
Right, well, I'll tell you one thing not to do. Don't go onto YouTube and look up my name and the word penalty okay?
We've been through this. You're definitely not on penos just yet after that. Haven't been forgiven.
No, exactly. But the odd thing is, if you're actually the designated one, that's fine. That clears it up. There's usually, you know, a designated number one. And sometimes I can remember my career at various points with various clubs and with the Scottish national team, I was that guy. But there's still a debate. If you walk up when you're having the stinker of a game or not confident for whatever reason or have a little bit of an injury, you might have been the person who was brought down and your leg's aching a bit, whatever. You still have the opportunity to turn around at number two and say, actually, you have it. Or he can say, are you sure you fancy it? But there should, I think most people accept there should be a number one. You know, before you go out, that the guy who's on them is on them. And he's actually got in his mind, and he should have on his mind before he starts, where he's actually going to put that penalty before the start of the game. Unless you are one of a very select number of people, and those select number of people are the likes of Eden Hazard or Jorginho or to some degree Paul Pogba, who make their mind up as they do that slow run-up. Thing is, he never done a slow run-up, did he? He did that kind of normal penalty kick kind of thing. It muddies the waters, and I don't think you need muddied waters when you've got a penalty kick and it's an important penalty kick. You want to be focused on your mind. You're the one. And if you don't want to be the one, you hand it on to number two, who almost always is desperate to grab it anyway. It's not unheard of to have two guys and having a mature conversation. They appeared to have that in both the penalty kicks you're talking about. So, you know, you accept it to some degree, as long as it goes in the back of the net.
Yeah.
Do you know the biggest concern is, and this is where it's like, the power dynamics, which is what Neville was talking about there. If the power dynamics is one guy's a massive personality and a strongest personality possibly in the group, he'll take it because he's the strongest personality, not because he's the right guy to take the penalty. And that is the concern with Pogba. You know, there have been times, and he's missed a few now, that it's just because of who he is. And, you know, you would wonder if he's trying to sell his brand because he needs to get more goals or whatever. I don't think it was that in that case. The conversation, I've looked through it two or three times. I think many people have. It seemed to be a fairly sensible conversation. Yeah. Do you fancy it? Yeah, I fancy it. Yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah, I didn't even look as if Rashford was hiding some kind of anger or disappointment as such. There was no acrimony in it. Like if Pogba had stepped up and scored it, then I think there'd be raised eyebrows, I suppose. But I don't think anybody, there wouldn't be the same hoo-ha about the whole thing. I guess it's hard. There's instantly question marks over the system, I suppose, when Rashford has just scored a penalty of that quality against Chelsea, and then within a week, I'm sure his confidence hasn't deserted him in a week, this happens and Pogba seems to end up taking the penalty. There's no logic to that beyond, well, Pogba's pulled rank here because he's the more senior player, and that's probably the worry.
Yeah, well, that is the fear and that is the concern. The other side of it is, and I don't think this, I'll give you this argument, I don't think it holds water anymore.
Yeah.
But it used to hold water, which was, you took a penalty last week, the keeper knows which way you like to go.
Yeah.
You know, so you've taken two in a week, you know, and then the keeper knows where you went last time and it was a goal, so you're tempted to do the same thing again. I mean, it's a mind games thing, and, you know, that happens in every single penalty kick. That doesn't actually hold water anymore, because every goalkeeper has got a list of every penalty taker and where they like to put them. So that used to be an argument. I don't think it's an argument anymore, because they've got so much data that they actually work on now that that doesn't work anymore. Again, it might have just been down to that, you know, do you fancy it? My suspicion is Pogba's the bigger personality, and if he damn well wants it, he'll damn well take it kind of thing. And that's the way it works. And, you know, it's not just football. Life's a bit like that. You know, the bigger personality can, bully's a strong word on this occasion, but he can, you know, force his personality in the other. And of course, Pogba's a bit older. Rashford, to some degree, still just, you know, in the team. He's not been in that long, but long enough, it should be quite strong. But it's not perfect, and it's not suitable. And even though I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has said, you know, that's not going to happen again, and it's going to happen again the same way, I suspect they'll adapt that now. I think they need to clarify it within their group. And probably everybody, not just the fans, not just the public, not just the people that are the punters, the guys that are talking about it on television, the pundits, not just them, the players. More importantly, the players. They feel more comfortable with it because you know what you've got to do.
Because it probably only takes a slight tweaking of the system, you know? It would appear, based on Pogba's four misses in 12 months, that there's a question mark over his penalty taking. So let's assume Rashford at the moment looks like the better penalty taker. Then there is a logic to what Solskjaer's getting at, which, you know, footballers have dips and feel better certain days than others, or, as you said, may have had a kick in the leg or maybe gone through a bad patch in the match, whatever it may be. But maybe, like, a simple tweaking is, well, Rashford, you're the penalty taker. if for whatever reason you don't fancy it, I've no problem with that. I want you to feel confident that you can put your hand up and say that, in which case Paul Pogba takes the penalty. But this business of a consultation before every penalty, that just seems to add a layer of extra pressure to every single penalty. Whistle goes. So say Rashford in particular fancies it when the whistle goes. He then has to think to himself, ugh, before I even have to take the penalty, I have to negotiate with the alpha male in the group.
Yeah, exactly. But I have to be honest about it and absolutely upfront about it. I have worked under managers who said, whoever feels confident at the time, get up there and take it.
Right.
I've worked under that system as well. You'd need to do one hell of a metadata study to figure out which one's the best of that one. But certainly that's been the case in the past as well. There's usually two or three that do generally fancy it. I have to say, I came across it once myself in that one. Near the end, last part of my career, playing for Tranmere, and I'd scored two goals already. And I decided I wanted to take the penalty because I fancied a hat-trick. Missed it. Went in, and the manager, Mr. J. Aldridge Esquire, was waiting for me afterwards. And he was not happy at all because I wasn't the designated one. So, you know, it's so much more easy for everyone concerned if it's clarified.
Well, say Pogba takes 90% of them. You use the word bullying, which, you know, is too strong a word. I'm going to use the word like emasculating, which is too strong a word. But for like Rashford, every time there's a penalty that he doesn't take, you know, say it's 9 out of 10, there's a little bit like everybody knows you haven't kind of stood up for yourself or you've lost that one as well. You know, I just think as a 21-year-old, you've got enough on your plate.
Yeah, and that might be part of it as well. But you've got team dynamics all the way and group dynamics all the way through everything. It's not just penalty kicks. Mm. You know, have a look at free kicks. They're the same.
Yeah.
They're exactly the same. You know, 20 yards out, 25 yards out. I've watched plenty of teams over the years where I'm thinking, well, you shouldn't be taking that penalty because that's not your specialist area. It's on the left. You're a right footer.
Yeah.
Should be leaving it to the lefty. But the bigger personality goes up and takes it. And that's just what happens. I mean, going right to the top of the tree, can you remember all those years with Roberto Carlos for Brazil? Took millions of free kicks.
He never scored
any.
You know.
But big personality, one scored an absolute stormer. And that can kind of hold sway as well. It's grotesque, it's stupid, it's unfair.
Yeah.
And it gets back to the initial point. It should be the gaffer that tells them. And then there's no debate.
Do you suspect this is Solskjaer? God, we keep using the wrong word here, too strong a word. I'm going to use it anyway. Is he a little bit afraid of putting anybody's nose at a joint here? Like, what's the issue with just him as a manager making the decision? Maybe the other side of that coin is, well, I want to empower my players and that's great and everything, but I don't know. There's certain areas where the manager should just take things out of players' hands. Why do you think at a deep level he hasn't decided to just make this decision for the players?
I think it's his personality. And his personality is kind of, you know, when he talks, okay, he'll be very single-minded in various areas, right? He will be that, right? But there'll be other areas where he's, you know, he chats after and he's quite laid back. There will be parts of his personality and parts of his game plan that will be a bit more laissez-faire. Mm. And that's just a little bit of his personality. I think it comes across in a whole bunch of the interviews that he does. And even the interview afterwards, you know, he'll, as lots of managers used to say, they can have a sense of humour bypass like the best of them. But there's a bit of his personality you can see in there that is a bit laid back and he's not going to get too uptight about it.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the area. You couldn't imagine Fergie leaving any doubt there. But, you know, there is more than one way to skin a cat. Mm. The odd thing is, because it's not worked, it becomes a massive, massive debate. I think they will have that discussion over the next week or two. And certainly, I don't think with the next penalty kick, you'll see two people debating it.
No.
I think somebody will walk up, pick up that ball and smack it. And I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Bloody better be Rashford as well. I mean, in fairness. Like, if Pogba goes and takes the next one, then I'm thinking, right, the manager needs to step in. I just had this sudden memory, well, two as we're talking, and both kind of Man United sort of related. One is when Forlan joined the club and he really struggled at the start in particular to settle in, and Van Nistelrooy had scored two or three goals. The game was over. They win a penalty towards the end and the penalty was offered to Forlan. I think even Van Nistelrooy was happy, which would be rare for him, obviously, and he offered it to Forlan. And Roy Keane stepped in and said, absolutely not, and took the ball off Forlan, gave it back to Ruud. Ruud puts it in the net for like a 5-6-0 win. And that's kind of the ruthlessness, the brilliance maybe of that kind of leadership that he had. And then the other one was against Greece, the famous Beckham free kick in 01. He'd missed a load of frees that game, a bit like you're talking about. And when he got the famous one that he scores, Teddy Sheringham, who I'm sure could hit a free kick if he wanted, came over and really remonstrated with Beckham a few times. Beckham shoved him away. Sheringham came back another time. Beckham had missed loads at this stage, and Beckham still said, no, 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 I'm taking it. And these are all the dynamics, I guess, which go on.
There's two different stories against those two stories.
Yeah.
So the first one, you would say, had Forlan been allowed to take it and scored it, that dip he was in might have been lifted slightly, and it might have been a good thing. And you know, would it have affected Ruud van Nistelrooy in any big way? No. So, you know, there's another viewpoint in that. So, I mean, that is two ways of looking at it. Every single one of those situations will have a different way of looking at it. And as you think it's a right and wrong, and you only ever find out when it's in the back of the net. That's the only thing you find out when it's in the back of the net. And if, to be honest, Forlan was a great player, and they came back on it, a brilliant game. What was the second one you said there again?
Beckham and Sheringham against Greece. Now, Beckham's entitled to shove anyone away. Yeah.
Well, that's a classic one, actually, because the big thing that most people forget about that game is Beckham had given the ball away for Greece to score the goal that they scored, and he was wanting redemption. He was desperate for redemption at that point in time, because had they suffered and he'd not scored that goal, all the fingers were pointing at him. He was the one that was at fault for the goal that would have knocked him out anyway. So, you know, there's a selfishness in there as well that he needed and felt that, and he was brave enough to go and do it, and he got it right on that occasion. It's every single time we all know better in retrospect. See, at the time, it's a flip of the coin.
Yeah. Vindication by the result, always, almost in every case. What did you make, by the way, of United generally then?
You know, it was a great first half. I thought they were really, really good in the first half, you know, real strength. Again, you'll have heard me say many things before, I would have had Martial as the centre-forward before Lukaku all the time. I like him better as a player. I think he's more of a team player. And I think if anybody watched the game on Sky last night, they will have noticed the stats about who scored more goals in the period of time that Martial's been there. And it's Martial scored more goals in more games than Lukaku has. And Martial has been stuck out in the wing all that time. Martial's an all-round... okay, he might not look as big and as strong, and you notice the Lukaku goals. I'm not saying he's a terrible player, Lukaku. I think they'll look a better team if you put Martial there more often than not, because he'll link up with players and he's adaptable as well. He can go wide and Rashford can go in and take the centre forward position for periods of time, you know, make it a much more fluid thing. So that side of it, I think that's a good sign. Certainly at the back with Maguire, they'll look a million times better with Maguire at the back. He didn't miss much, did he? So that's a massive difference from they've been waiting how many years to get that centre back that looks the real deal, and he's the real deal for them. So that's fine. Do they look like a team that's going to go and challenge for the top two or three? Nah, still a wee bit away.
Yeah.
And the impressive thing is, for all that domination, Wolves never rolled over, did they? They just kept on going, and then they got their space and they got their time. And it's amazing how many teams that's happened to this, particularly this weekend. Often happens at the start of seasons, you know, people are not 100% match fit. United faded a bit. Remember, Liverpool faded at the weekend as well. I was at the Chelsea game. Boy, did they fade with bells on. You know, you need to make sure you're brave enough to keep on going.
Well, I did want to ask you about Chelsea then. Point number one to make, it's going to be fun.
They're
going to be entertaining. I put this to Stephen Hunt, who was in studio last night. He didn't quite manage to get it. So we'll test your Chelsea credentials here. Mason Mount scored with Frank Lampard as manager. The last English player to score for an English manager at Chelsea?
Ooh, for an English manager. That's going back a bit, isn't it? I'd never get that. That's too far.
Dennis Wise for Glenn Hoddle.
God, that is incredible. Yeah. Huge amount of time. I thought it was about that long. It's been so long. By the way, I was at the game, and it was really intriguing to watch Mount in particular in that first half specifically. Honestly, it was almost funny how many of the similar positions he took up to Frank Lampard. the way Frank Lampard played.
Right.
That number eight, left of midfield, always wanting to get into the box. He could have scored three goals. He only got the one. And it's incredible. And it's this Frank Lampard's in his head and said, look, every time the ball's there, you go there and just keep on going and keep on going. Because he's got a good engine on him, Mount, he is doing it. Now, here's the downside for him. He actually might go and arrive in there as often as Frank Lampard. He ain't as good a finisher as Frank Lampard. Lampard was an amazing, particularly one-touch finisher. So he'll get in there and he'll get goals and he'll certainly add to the team. I'm not sure he'll play every single week, but he was among the best players in the Chelsea team for that first 25, 30 minutes. After that, like the rest of the Chelsea team, they kind of collapsed a little bit. And I think it's kind of obvious reasons why they did. I watched them all the way through pre-season. Not enough of those players have had 90 minutes.
Right.
You looked at N'Golo Kante, and I was saying during the commentary, I'm going to say a phrase now that I can't believe I'm saying, and I've never said it before. N'Golo Kante looked knackered. I've never said it before in all the time watching him. But he was wrecked. So if he's wrecked, having said that, he's played a total of 18 minutes in the pre-season, so you're not going to be fully match fit.
And he'd played in Istanbul, hadn't he? He was on the ball a lot in Istanbul. He was good on the ball.
Yeah, he wrecked himself. That was it. He put everything in there. I thought he was fantastic in Istanbul. But, you try and just walk into it. It's like going into high altitude. You'll do all right for a wee while, then you'll completely collapse. You need the games under your belt. And I know he looks like a Superman sometimes, but him, along with a whole bunch of the rest of that group, just fell apart. And that game, in Istanbul, the travelling, the 120 minutes, the penalty, finishing late at night, all that stuff, stick it all on top. It wrecked him. And I remember Chelsea tried to play a really high tempo game in that first half of that game. And they could have been 2-3, maybe even 4 up. And that they could have probably survived it. But I think Chelsea fans shouldn't over worry about that yet, because it's not as if they're going to fall apart every week. That fitness will get better every week. And if they played the way they did for the first 25, 30 minutes, every week, they're cruising. They'll have a great season.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure they will.
Okay, are you not? Okay. Because when they're having their good spells, they look really good. Yeah. And it's funny. Like, this has been one of the great exercises in lowering expectations. They did win the Europa League and finished third last year. And we're talking about them like they're plucky underdogs. I know Eden Hazard is a big loss. But, they do look good when they're good. And if they all get the minutes under their belt and start clicking a little bit, I don't know, I think they're certainly nothing to be afraid of if they're looking at Man United as the most likely fourth place finishers.
Yeah, well, there was a hammering of 4-0 against Manchester United, but that was an odd result. The way they played against Liverpool, it was really good. And that certainly gave a lot of hope to Frank Lampard and any Chelsea fans watching. And that first 25, 30 minutes, that showed that, intrigued by his methodology. And he's very attack-minded within that group. There's two questions still to be answered. And one of the massive ones is who's going to score all the goals.
Yeah.
And everybody's asked a question, and they're right to ask a question because nobody knows yet. The midfielders will come in and maybe add something to it, but there's not that many teams, unless your name's Frank Lampard, that can rely on the midfielder getting 20-odd goals a season, which you need somebody to do that. The other thing is they've still not got their back line sorted out. The back line's, really looking, shaky's not the right word, but it's not gelled yet. They're waiting for Rudiger to come back. So you're right.
He played for the 23s, didn't he, the other night?
Yeah. When he comes back, he'll walk into the team and he'll be number one of the centre-backs and somebody will go alongside him. But that's, you keep on saying that about Chelsea. It's a bit as if they're kind of walking a little bit of a tightrope. They're hoping somebody will score a goal here or there. Tammy Abraham, it's not happened for him yet. He's had quite a few chances. It's still not quite happened for him, but it might still work because he can score goals. Giroud had a great game at the weekend there. His layoff play was brilliant. Of course, he was exhausted after a period of time as well. But there isn't an obvious player in that group that's going to actually go and score that bunch of goals that they need if they're going to really push up for the top four. If they get top four, I think it'd be an amazing job with Frank Lampard. He needs a year.
Yeah, fair point. And just the last one on Chelsea. Do you know what kind of personality Abraham is? Because, he could say to himself, stay calm, I'm getting in good positions at times and there's going to be certain pockets in the season where things should click for me and some of those chances will go in. But geez, equally, I'd say when you're a young player, you're confidence in yourself could plummet and it could all start feeling very self-conscious very quickly. Do you know what kind of guy he is?
Well, it's because he's so young, he's changing. He was quite shy when he walked into the first team that we could see, and he's a sweet boy kind of thing. He's not over arrogant, but he's confident enough in himself when he's on the field. So all the things are there that I kind of quite like about a player. And he will grow in personality and confidence as well as physically, which he needs to. He's really tall, but he needs to fill out. You know, he's one of those lads that when he does, he'll be a different prospect as well. One of the things he really needed is he needed the fans behind him. And I think that's probably maybe the most important point of the whole thing that happened at the weekend there. He came on and the reception he got was amazing. And Chelsea fans were saying two things. Number one, you missed a penalty at Istanbul. Don't worry, we get it. You're young, you're coming, we're behind you, you came through the youth system. Number two, there were a few morons online who had racist things written about Tammy after missing that penalty kick. Just as the same as happened to Paul Pogba as well. The great thing is, sitting in that stadium, everybody made the point. It was so loud. No, no. We as a group, we are behind you. So the losers, morons, small minority of, you know, keyboard warriors out there that do not represent the group. And that's Man United, that's Chelsea, that's all football fans. They got behind him. And it's great to see that. And if he gets the fans behind him, they're good. I've been there before. They're a great group to have behind you, and that will help him.
I guess clock coming against us to neatly wrap this up. Man City 2, Spurs 2. Even Pochettino came out and said, yeah, they were just so much better than us. Like, I can't even pretend they weren't. 30 shots to 3, according to the stats, 2, according to Pep, who refused to count Harry Kane's effort from way out. But 30 shots. De Bruyne alone created 9 chances. This was the most impressive 2-2. The most impressive point earned, I think, I've ever seen by a team that were that good.
Yeah. I think they will be better this season. And I've thought that all along. And part of it is they've got De Bruyne. Mm. And they didn't have him for the vast majority of last season. And he just looks absolutely his best already. And the odd thing is that kind of almost fallow season that he had, he's probably rejuvenated him and he's rested all the bits of his body that he needs to. And he's not going to come into this season feeling anything other than brilliantly fresh. So, you know, absolutely. No concerns about Manchester City. They're going to be either first or second and almost certainly first. It's just intriguing to see, you know, how he manages it with the Champions League, because you get the feeling this season they put Champions League before the league and they would probably be right to do that. Intriguing to watch Aguero going off and the dynamic there with them two. It could have been massive and huge because there's a big argument with Pep and him when he came off. And then it was like making up afterwards. And, you know, people think, oh, who's given in there? Who's done the right thing? Who's done the wrong thing? That's just a bunch of guys. That's what they're like.
Yeah.
They fall out now and again. And if you're big enough and you're a man enough, you get on with it. And most footballers are generally like that. It's just that playing out in front of every camera now, we tend to see it more often.
Pep's definitely not afraid of doing that. He will give Sterling a tactical talk in front of the cameras at full time. He will come over to opposition players and remonstrate with them. Like, he's no fool. He knows the cameras are on him. I can't work out sometimes what it is. Is he so obsessive and lost in the moment, he momentarily forgets the attention that's on him? Or is there an element of, like, brand Pep at work here? Look at me, tactically enlightening lesser mortals, and I'm going to do it on the pitch every time. I'm quite decided what I think there.
I'm going to say something about Pep that he would hate me passionately for.
Yeah.
He's getting a wee bit like Mourinho in that way. He knows he's using it. And it's that classic Mourinho one they said to me once. I said to him, what's the most important thing when you're talking to people after a game and you're talking to the press? Is it the press, the fans? Is it the referee? Is it your players? Is it the board? Who is it? Who are you talking to? And he goes, number what? Number three, my players. Number two, my players. Number one, my players. Everything he does is aim back to the group to say, I'm in control. I'm doing it. And if it's got a secondary advantage, like we all see it, or the brand Pep thing, I'm not convinced with that either. The thing I'm convinced about is he does things that he knows will work for his group. And he's good at it and he's getting better.
Yeah. We're out of time. I did make a silent resolution to myself at the start of the season I wouldn't talk to you about VAR every week. So I'm quite happy that we can come back to that next week. Well, you know, let the things settle in if that's okay. Unless there's a burning point you must make.
No, still getting them all right.
Exactly.
That's it.
Yeah. Okay, listen, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. See you soon.
See you. Pat Nevin there. Usually with us every Monday. Back with us next Monday. talking to us now, our football coverage. And by the way, Blackburn 1-0 up against Hull in the 91st minute on the live game on Sky this evening. Our football coverage is brought to you thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit dunlewey.net. Up next, so Bayern drew 2-2 in their first Bundesliga game of the season. Dortmund, seen as their biggest challengers, were 5-1 winners. We are going to talk to expert German football writer Uli Hesse. That's next.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, returning football shirts to the fans. Join the movement today by using hashtag Save Our Shirt.
Now you're welcome back. So we're turning to German football. We have Uli Hess, German football writer, a regular guest on the show down the years, on the line. You're there, Uli?
I'm here. I can hear you well. Jeff.
Good. Excellent. Thanks so much for joining us. So the Bundesliga season, set it up for us then. Bayern are going for an eighth straight title, and the big question is, can Dortmund stop them? Is that about right?
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, Leipzig are still in there with an outside chance, you know. Most people don't realize that, but if they can keep Timo Werner, you know, sometimes linked by Munich, sometimes not, then I think they have a good chance of, you know, joining in the race somehow.
I was reading the interesting news from the Bayern hierarchy in recent times is that Uli Hoeneß has confirmed his retirement. So tell us about that. Is that as straightforward as it seems? There's nothing Machiavellian going on. And who are the big power brokers now at the top of the Bayern tree?
Yeah, it's a very, I mean, number one, you can't really imagine Bayern Munich without Uli Hoeneß. Number two, Bayern Munich won't really be without Uli Hoeneß. You know, even if he steps down, you know, he'll still be sort of, I don't know, maybe an honorary president or whatever. As long as he's there, he will have his say. But it's been, I mean, we're certainly going to talk about that, about Bayern Munich's transfer policy, which has been less than overwhelming over the last couple of years. And part of the problem may be, you know, I'm just guessing, but maybe that, you know, for quite a long time, Uli Hoeneß and Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, you know, they're very different people and they have a very different outlook on football. But for quite a number of years, this has worked really well, you know, so that they seem to have been able to find a middle ground, and maybe they can no longer do that. Maybe, you know, a lot of people are saying right now that, you know, the game has sort of passed Uli Hoeneß by and his values are no longer the values of the modern game. So this could be part of, you know, Bayern's most recent transfer problems.
Okay. And was Uli Hoeneß still very much hands-on in a very big and decisive way regarding Bayern Munich's transfer policy? The club hadn't moved on in that regard overly.
Yeah, I mean, I think his opinion is, I'm fairly sure that they're not going to sign anybody without Hoeneß saying yes or no, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's just to give you one example, that one of the big stories of the transfer summer has been that Mats Hummels went back to Borussia Dortmund. And he was one player that it's been an open secret that Uli Hoeneß was never really a big fan of Mats Hummels as a player, you know? Mm. Not that he didn't rate him quality-wise, but the sort of player that Mats Hummels is was not the sort of defender, you know, that Uli Hoeneß liked. So that was certainly one major reason why Hummels, you know, went back to Dortmund, because he didn't feel that he got quite, you know, the respect that he deserved at Bayern.
So will Karl-Heinz Rummenigge rule the roost then, or has the structure changed massively, or how are things going to go for Bayern over the next couple of years?
This is the big question, you know, because they technically have what used to be called the business manager or director of football, call it what you will, in Hasan Salihamidžić, you know, the former player, who hasn't really, you know, he hasn't set the world alight, you know, on the transfer stage so far. And some people say it's because he's sort of in between, you know, Hoeneß and you know, he's sort of stuck between two alpha males, Hoeneß and Rummenigge, and hasn't been quite able to assert himself.
Yeah.
Which is another factor in this ongoing Bayern transfer saga.
And Uli, when the Bayern transfers were working well, like traditionally, what kind of players were they bringing in? Like, what's a good example of the Bayern Munich way? Because I would just see them as basically hoovering up the best talent in German football from all the other clubs, and then maybe a sprinkle of very good international talent, but they weren't breaking transfer records by the same token.
Exactly, exactly. That's pretty much right. So the funny thing is that that you could say pretty much the sort of deals that Dortmund made this season would have been a couple of years ago, typical Bayern Munich deals. Mm. Yeah, they brought in Nico Schulz and Julian Brandt, you know, two German internationals, two great talents. And over the last couple of years, it's normally been, you know, the Bayern Munich way to make sure, that, you know, they have the saying at the club that, that we're going to make sure that every really top-class German player would be playing for Bayern Munich. Mm. So that's, you know, the bulk of the national team would be at Bayern Munich. And as you said, including a sprinkling of international talent, and this hasn't happened so far. I mean, now they've got Coutinho, of course.
Yeah.
But it seems more like, you know, it has the feel of a desperate last gasp measure, you know.
Yeah.
It's an open secret. They would have loved to sign Leroy Sané, even though probably, which is another, to come back to Uli Hoeneß, which is another sort of deal that Uli Hoeneß would have made very, very grudgingly.
Okay.
It was only a couple of years ago that Hoeneß said that Bayern Munich would never sign a player for 100 million euros, you know. But now they sort of realised they have to do this.
Mm. Well, Coutinho could be an interesting test case because, as I understand it, the deal is they're going to pay 8.5 million euros to take the Brazilian on loan, but the option to buy still stands at 120 million at the end of the season. They unless Coutinho is very, 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 very good, I'm not sure they're paying 120 million euros for Coutinho, 28 years old, at the end of the season.
They're probably not, and it's and you know, quite a lot of people think that it's basically what they've done is they've exchanged James for Coutinho. You know, okay. A similar kind of player, and it does have a whiff of, we've got to do something now.
Mm.
Also, because I don't know if this has made the rounds outside of Germany as much as it did in Germany. It was a couple of months ago, Uli Hoeneß, there he is again,
mm.
He was on a television show back when he was still sort of, you know, you said he's stepping down, and yes, he's not, technically he's not running Bayern Munich, but he's, you know, he's the face and the voice of the club.
Mm.
So whenever there's, you know, a chat show or whatever, Uli Hoeneß gets invited. And they were grilling him about, you know, the fact that all those stars had retired, you know, from Robin and Ribéry and so on. And then who were they going to sign? And he replied, this was months ago, and he replied, you'd be surprised if you knew, you know, the sort of deals we already have secured. And so back then everybody thought, oh, gee, Bayern Munich, you know, they've got a couple of really good players in the bag. Now it turns out, at the point when Hoeneß made that statement, their biggest rivals, Borussia Dortmund, they already had quite a really good bunch of good transfers in the bag, while this was just bluffing.
And are there a generation of Thomas Müllers ready to leap from the Bayern Academy?
Yeah, that's another thing. They've been waiting for ages for that, really. It's, you know, David Alaba and Schweinsteiger and Thomas Müller, that generation is no longer there. You know, even the Bayern Munich reserves are playing in the third division now. I think they played yesterday evening.
Right.
And then, you know, the biggest star players were Jan Fiete Arp, the former Hamburg striker, and Alphonse Davies, the Canadian starlet. So even they are not homegrown players, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And Uli, Bayern obviously completely dominate the market in Germany. And it's a very wealthy area that they kind of dominate in particular as well. And nationally, so many supporters follow Bayern. And under kind of the old model, that would have had them very competitive from a financial point of view in Europe. Obviously, television money in the UK in particular has gone to a different level. So how much money do Bayern have in the bank? Like when Uli Hoeneß is saying things like, we'll never spend 100 million on a player. Do Bayern have that kind of cash if they did have a philosophy change?
Yeah, they could. I mean, they were prepared to do it. I mean, they were obviously very, very interested in signing Leroy Sané. And, you know, until Sané suffered an injury in the Charity Shield, it looked as if the deal would actually be happening.
Mm.
And they were certainly spent probably something about 120 million for him. So they do have that money. You know, not indefinitely, of course. I mean, that is the case even in England. You know, every summer one of the English clubs, you know, makes headlines by spending 200 or 220 million, but they don't do it every year.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Liverpool did it last year and didn't spend anything this season, and so on. So, so they could compete, but of course not indefinitely.
Yeah. I suspect Pep Guardiola, when he departs, leaves a long shadow. Manchester City will probably find that out in the coming years as well. Kovac in his second season now, how's he doing? What's the feeling on him? He's still a very young manager. Is he under big pressure, or is there an acceptance that he's not working with the same tools?
I think there's more pressure on him now than it was last year.
Okay.
Because last year he was widely accepted that it's really a very, very difficult job to come in at Bayern Munich. You know, and then he had a very bad start of the season, and you know, but now there's sort of the feeling that for some reason Bayern's transfer deals are not working. You know, they're not really addressing the problems they have in the squad, and of course, you know, it's not quite as it is in England, where you sometimes have a manager, you know, who's coaching the team and also doing the deals. So in Germany, that has always been very, very strictly separated. Mm. But there's also the feeling that the coach should address these problems, and he should somehow get the board to get him the players that he needs. And there seems to be a power imbalance, you know, between, on the one hand, Niko Kovac and Hasan Salihamidžić, and between the, you know, the traditional top dogs at Bayern Munich, Jürgen Rummenigge. Another funny thing, sorry.
Yeah.
Funny thing is, which sometimes gets overlooked, is that personally I think that the Bayern's problems started, you know, they started last season. Because actually they did spend a lot of money this season. They already spent 120 million euros on Lucas Hernandez, on Benjamin Pavard. When last season, just 1 year ago, which is, this could win you quite a lot of euros down at the pub. Just how many euros did Bayern spend last season on transfers? And the answer is 10.
Right.
They spent 10 million euros on Alphonse Davies, the young Canadian.
Mm.
The other two big transfers were, well, you have to grant them that, they were free transfers. Compared to last season, they already have spent quite a lot of money.
Mm.
They have signed good players, only somehow not where they needed them, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
I mean, when suddenly at the beginning, you know, at the beginning of this transfer window, they suddenly had a ton of fullbacks, you know, centre-backs, which is why Mats Hummels left the club.
Yeah.
But they still haven't addressed the problem up front.
And a final one, Uli, how do Bayern position themselves when it comes to the Champions League and European success? Obviously, we're all familiar with the heritage and tradition of the club, but it sounds like from what you're saying that just maintaining dominance in Germany would be a significant achievement. Does the do the people at the club talk about Europe in very realistic terms and we should be winning the Champions League, or have expectations almost diminished just to dominating in Europe and we'll make the knockout stage of the Champions League and see what happens?
No, they haven't diminished, but they should have.
Yeah.
From what I hear, they still seriously think they can compete on the European stage. I mean, they point to the last couple of seasons when they had quite a lot of bad luck and they could have progressed and could have gone to the final. But seriously, and I don't know if, I mean, I'm not quite sure how much this, you know, this is registering at the club itself. I mean, the fan base is still, most people, most writers and fans are still think that, you know, that Bayern should compete for the Champions League. And, you know, that the Bundesliga is sort of the bread and butter game, but that, you know, the Holy Grail is the Champions League.
Yeah.
I think it was almost 2 years ago now that Robert Lewandowski toyed with a move. You know, he even changed his agent, and he was really, really looking for a move. And it was an open secret back then that the main reason Lewandowski did this was that he felt that he no longer had a serious chance at winning the Champions League with Bayern Munich. You know, I mean, this guy has won the Bundesliga, I don't know what, 10 times running or whatever. Yeah. He's won the Golden Boot, so he wants to win the Champions League. And, you know, I think he was quite realistically, he saw the club's chancing diminishing with every season. Now they have the problem that Robin Ribery are no longer there. But last season, the problem was that Robin Ribery was certainly, you know, getting on in age, you know, and would no longer be able to play on a consistent basis. So that problem has been there all along, and they haven't been able really to address that. Okay. I mean, they need a much deeper squad for the Champions League. You know, I mean, they have problems. They're going to have problems in the Bundesliga now as it stands, but for the Champions League, they need a much deeper squad. Just imagine. I mean, I keep saying this for like ages, but just imagine Robert Lewandowski is sort of becomes halfway mortal and suffers an injury, you know, not a serious injury, not a fractured leg or whatever, just the normal kind of normal injury that means you miss 8 or 9 games. It would be, you know, a catastrophe for Bayern Munich. So far, for some reason, Lewandowski, you know, has been almost superhuman. You know, he was never injured at Dortmund. He was almost never injured at Bayern Munich. But, you know, one day he will suffer an injury. And what then?
Yeah, what then indeed. Ulias, thanks so much for filling us in and all of that. Very interesting. Thank you.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Space. He'll give you a move with godly grace.